Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Organ transplantation can save lives. But what about non-life-saving transplants? They include the first-in-the-world type of penis transplant recently performed at Johns Hopkins Hospital. What's the balance between risk and benefit? And should donors be able to say yes to some transplants and not so fast to others? Plus, California investigators say they may have caught a killer in a decades-old cold case using the genetic information available now on an Ancestry website. Have you posted your genetic profile online? Should you? Dr. Jeffrey Kahn of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics joins me for this edition of Midday on Ethics. Plus, Sean Yost is here with the Afro Check-In. That's all coming up when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us here on Midday today. Before we begin, we have posted on our website a link to a piece in the Baltimore Sun about how we can help the victims of the flooding in Ellicott City. The historic town was severely flooded for the second time in 2 years over the weekend. I'm sure you've heard about it. So come to wipr.org/midday. And we'll have a list of all of the organizations that are helping victims with shelter and food and other humanitarian relief. So today on the program, it's another edition of Midday on Ethics. We'll explore some ethical questions pulled straight from the headlines. We'll begin with the ethics of organ transplantation amid news of a medical breakthrough, a transplant performed just a few weeks ago at Johns Hopkins Hospital here in Baltimore. For the first time anywhere, doctors successfully performed a total penis and scrotum transplant on a service member who was injured in Afghanistan. Now that it's possible to transplant a penis or a uterus, what are the ethical issues that donors and recipients and transplant surgeons need to consider? Should we think about life-saving transplants like hearts and kidneys in the same way as non-life-saving surgeries, the so-called quality of life transplants? So a caution to our listeners, we are going to be talking about penile transplantation. And if you are with some kids or with folks who you don't think should be hearing that kind of stuff, you may want to tune out for about 45 minutes. We also want to talk about another news story if we have time. This one is another one that caught our eye. California investigators used publicly available genetic information that was posted on an Ancestry website to identify someone that they say is the Golden State Killer. He has been charged with murders the police say he committed more than 30 years ago. So is your genetic information publicly available? And should it be? And if so, should it be more private than it is? Dr. Jeffrey Kahn is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He joins me today. He stops by from time to time to help us explore how ethicists frame these kinds of very complex questions. Jeff, it's good to see you.
Good to be with you.
And if you'd like to weigh in on our conversation with Dr. Kahn, our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet at Midday WYPR. Jeff Kahn, this organ transplantation, a service member, as I mentioned, severely injured in his groin in Afghanistan. Tell us what the surgeons, this is a large surgical team, 11 physicians in a 17-hour operation. Tell us what they were able to do for this young man.
So my my colleagues, as you have pointed out at Johns Hopkins, actually are a different transplant team than the ones who do kidney, heart, liver, so-called solid organ transplants. And the team that do the kinds of transplants we're talking about today are plastic surgeons, nerve surgeons. They're actually doing a different kind of surgery, and those surgeries are actually called vascular composite allografts. So it's vascular, that's the blood supply, composite because it's tissue and bone and nerve and blood supply. And allograft means from a different person, a person not you. And so it's a different team, and they're not only doing penis transplants, as you've already pointed out, but they also, prior to this case, have been working on hand hand transplants and face transplants. So these are the kinds of transplants that those surgical teams work on. And in this case, they were able to, as you pointed out, transplant from a cadaver donor, a dead donor, the penis and scrotum from that deceased person to this young man who had been grievously injured in Afghanistan when his Humvee drove over an IED and blew off the lower parts of his body. And so among the commitments that the military makes to service men and women is, if they're injured, we will do what we can to make you as good as you were before, right? That's the commitment. And this is the sort of, in that theme, an attempt to put him back together.
Mm-hmm. And this transplantation took place in at the end of March. The hospital announced it, told folks about it at the end of April. This young man has been released from the hospital. He wishes to remain anonymous. And the doctors say that, you know, this is reconstructive surgery, and they think that they can return him to basically normal urinary and sexual function, which is really quite extraordinary. This is the first time anybody's ever done it. So do you happen to know what the barriers to doing it were before? What were the hurdles that they had to overcome that they were evidently able to overcome in this instance?
So I'll share with you the level of detail that I know and understand. And I should say that comes from having spent about 2 years with this team, helping them think through the ethics and policy aspects. So I have been in meetings with all of those folks over the course of a lot of time and picked up a lot along the way. It would be useful to bring Andy Lee or his colleagues in to talk about the more technical details if you're interested. So it turns out that there's good plastic reconstruction available for all sorts of things. It turns out you can't really make a penis for someone who has lost one that will function in the same way as the one that men are born with. The innervation, the way the blood flow works, it will maybe look relatively close, but it won't work in quite the same way. And so to provide, after somebody has been injured in the way this service man was, it required either reconstruction and then implantation of a pump with literally a hand pump for air or hydraulic to make it work. Or the thought was maybe a cadaveric from a deceased donor, a penis could be transplanted. But it's all of the things you would imagine are the barriers to answer your question. It's very complicated to reattach. Right, with all of the nerves and blood and urinary supply from a dead person who is not related to the person who needs the penis transplant onto that person, and make sure that it would not be rejected. So that's the part about non-life-saving versus life-saving transplant. There are significant risks when you have foreign tissue transplanted into your own body. You need to make sure that doesn't get rejected, and that requires a drug regimen, which has its own side effects and risks. And so all of that had to be worked out using animal models before the first human case could go forward. And this is the first human case.
Yeah. And as you say, the chances of rejection of any organ that gets transplanted from an outside source is high in any instance. And of course, this time being the first time they've done it, they really, you know, to a certain extent, weren't quite sure what was going to happen.
With a lot of knowledge about rejection of foreign tissue from other kinds of transplants, so we shouldn't say this, you know, no one knew what this would be like. That said, it's a different calculation and risk benefit balance when it's, say, a heart transplant, a life-saving transplant. You could not survive unless you got a transplant of a heart, a liver, kidney is often talked about in this way too. And that's a different calculus, understanding, of course, I will accept the risks of rejection and the side effects of the drugs I have to take in order to save my life. But in the case of a hand transplant or a face transplant or a penis transplant, the people who need those transplants can live without having them. And so performing the transplant with all of the side effects and potentials for rejection and the risk that comes along with that has to be thought about differently in the context of a transplant that's non-life-saving. That said, there's an incredible change in the quality of that individual's life, which gets, in some cases, very close to saving their life. It's a different kind of life-saving, but I think it's not quite right to make this bright line distinction between life-saving and non-life-saving in ways that we can talk about.
And you mentioned for 2 years, you consulted with the team. This is a team of 9 plastic surgeons, 2 urological surgeons. As I said, a lengthy surgery. I think I said 17 hours. Hopkins is actually reporting it was 14 hours. It's still a long day in the OR for everybody involved, including the patient. What are some of the ethical issues that you framed for this team before they embarked on this really historic operation?
So among the first were the kinds of considerations we've now just been talking about. When is it acceptable to expose the individual to the risk associated with the transplant for something that is not life-saving? So that's one. I learned in the process, and we learned in the process, a lot about how individuals who suffer these kinds of injuries think about their lives after such an injury. And I will say these are young men who are in their 20s. That means they're sort of at the height of their activity in relation to, you know, their sexuality, and they're maybe married, maybe not. Maybe they have a partner, maybe they don't, but that's that time of their life. And they will report, and I think it's true, that when individuals wake up after having gone through these horrible injuries, the first thing they ask about is, how's my junk? It's high on the list of things that matter to them. And so it alters the way one ought to think about the non-life-saving, air quotes there, aspects of a transplant like this. That's one. The second is around really where these organs would come from for transplantation. So they're deceased donors. And when we all go to the MVA to get our driver's license or have it renewed, you're asked about whether you'll be an organ donor. And you say, if you say yes, the box gets checked, or there's a little heart on our driver's license here in Maryland. And one imagines that you understand what that means at some level. It means your kidneys, your heart, your lungs, your liver will be taken and donated to somebody who needs it. But you probably don't imagine that includes your penis if you're a man, or your uterus if you're a woman. And so how do we need to think about the notion of what people have consented to, have agreed to upon their death, donate, when it's a novel transplant like this? And how do we go about then seeking an additional kind of consent from the family of the donor, because the donor would be deceased, and how to do that? So there was a lot of conversation about the process through which the organ procurement organization, that's the group that actually does the collecting of organs, what new and different processes they would need to go through, and then who ought to be thought of as eligible recipients, potential recipients, and the process through which they would need to go in terms of the consent that they would need to give for this brand new, never tried before surgery, and what their mental state might be in relation to their injury and what it means to them to no longer have a working penis. So those are the sort of big areas, lots of nuance within each of those categories. I'll stop talking so we can have a conversation, but those are the big kinds of issues that we discussed over those 2 years.
And again, listeners, we're getting very particular about the particulars of male and female anatomy here. But Jeff Kahn, one of the decisions that was made was in this young man's instance, a penis was transplanted, the scrotum was transplanted, but not the testicles of the cadaver where the donor agreed to this. Now, why is that?
So that's a really important point. And so if you think about the penis is the plumbing, right? The testicles, the testes, are where the sperm is produced. And so transplanting testicles along with the scrotum and the penis would not only make the plumbing function in the recipient, but would transplant the sperm-producing organs from the deceased donor to the recipient. So effectively make the deceased donor a sperm donor to this young man who's the recipient of the penis, and make that deceased donor a potential father in a way that he could not have consented, and not appropriate to do that. And so there was a bright line, I think appropriately drawn, between transplanting the mechanical parts, right, the plumbing, and not the part that produced the the sperm that would allow someone to reproduce, to have children. And so this young man, probably goes obvious, but I'll say it anyway, who received the penis and the scrotum is not able to have children with his own sperm. He lacks the ability to make sperm. So the penis will work. He needs to take hormones because his testicles are no longer present to make all of the male hormone functions work properly, but he will not make sperm.
Let's take a little break. We'll come back and take your calls and comments. Are you an organ donor? Are you, like Dr. Khan indicates, one of those folks with a little heart on your driver's license? Have you made the decision that should you die unexpectedly and suddenly, perhaps in an automobile accident, would you be willing to donate your organs? Because this is a decision that's made pretty quickly, given the fact that the organs aren't going to stick around and last forever. Are you one of the folks who's decided to do that? When we come back from a break, we'll talk about it. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. You can send me a tweet and follow me on Twitter @TomHallWIPR. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the broadcast tomorrow, Dr. Miho Tanaka will be here. She's a professor of orthopedic surgery and the director of the Women's Sports Medicine Program at Johns Hopkins Hospital. Dr. Tanaka will have fitness and safety tips ahead of Saturday's Baltimore 10-miler for those of you who are running that great race, or anyone who is active in any way. So if you have questions about orthopedic health, you are welcome to pose them to Dr. Miho Tanaka tomorrow right here on Midday. If you just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Jeffrey Khan. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We're talking about the ethical questions raised by a couple of issues that have been very much in the news, including the ancestry websites that people use to share their genetic information. We'll try to get to that in a little bit. We're also going to talk about a very famous, now historic achievement at Johns Hopkins, an operation that took place on a serviceman who was injured in Afghanistan. He received a penile and scrotum transplant. Our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@wipr.org, to send us a tweet @MiddayWIPR. So, Jeff Khan, one of the obvious questions that comes up about this has to do with transgender people and gender reassignment. We have a caller on the line, Jonathan in Annapolis. I believe you have a question in that regard. Welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Khan.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
So, yeah, I have a 24-year-old son, and obviously he's been closely watching the progression of the operations. And I'm just wondering if this is a breakthrough for the transgender community as well.
All right. So your son is transgender, born female, right?
Yeah.
And so Jeff Khan, obviously this is something that is going to be very front of mind for the transgender community.
Absolutely. Thank you for your call, Jonathan. And it's a very clear, connecting of dots. If this works in the case of a wounded member of the military, why wouldn't it work in the case of gender reassignment? And the argument may be actually their gender reassignment is a more straightforward kind of application, in that it isn't a wound field. You don't have scar tissue. You don't have injury. You're dealing with sort of a healthy person who can benefit from that transplant in a way that would be superior to the available alternatives. And so why not, I think, is really the question, rather than whether it's something that we should be talking about. I think the question is, of course we should be talking about it. It's a therapy that will be, I think, of higher quality than what's currently available, and that the view seems to be this is the direction that penile transplant will absolutely go, not instead of helping men who've been wounded, but in addition to. And I will say, we were talking off the air, among the features of these kinds of transplants is that there's a severe shortage, as I'm sure listeners know, of solid organs. There are not enough hearts and livers and lungs and kidneys for the people who are waiting for them. There are more penises that go with the people who die than can be used, at least for injury repair. And so it seems like an obvious question, and one that I'm sure the transplant community is not only grappling with, but discussing and making decisions about institution by institution, even as we speak.
How about on the other side of the gender spectrum, a transplantation of uteruses for a male who changes gender identity to female, or for a woman who has been injured in some way and has a non-functioning uterus or has lost a uterus for whatever reason?
Yeah, so they're not really equivalent, right? The way that uteruses are used and penises are used are not the same, although we think about the, you know, uterus is somehow the female equivalent, not quite. Uterus is for reproduction. And there have been a small number of successful uterus transplants performed, mostly in Sweden, interesting. And that's because gestational surrogacy is not permitted in Sweden. And so that means if a woman is not able to carry a pregnancy herself because she has been born without a uterus, which happens, or she had her uterus removed from a disease, she isn't able to carry a pregnancy herself. The only way that she could have a child is through adoption. In this country and many other countries in the world, you can actually pay somebody to carry a pregnancy for you. And that's your egg and your partner's sperm implanted into a gestational surrogate's uterus. In Sweden, that's not permitted. And so the only way to allow that kind of birth to happen is through the transplant of a uterus from usually a living, believe it or not, donor to a woman who can then try to carry a pregnancy through the course of those 9 months with that transplanted uterus. And most interesting, among the interesting differences, is that when that uterus has been used for a pregnancy, it is then removed. So it's a temporary transplant, which is unusual and different than any other kind of transplant that is performed. And so the first attempts in U.S. institutions have not been successful at uterus transplant. Johns Hopkins is talking about it. Cleveland Clinic is on pace, as is one of the Texas medical centers. I won't get the name right, so I won't describe it. But there is an effort around the country to introduce uterus transplants here in the United States as well.
That's wild, to transplant it and then remove it.
So the good news being you don't need to have a uterus for the rest of your life, right? It isn't necessary except for the purpose of carrying a pregnancy. And so to have it transplanted only for the term of that pregnancy makes a much different risk-benefit calculation.
We have a number of folks who want to weigh in about organ donation. Let's try to get to some of them. Anne in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I actually am an organ donor according to my license, but I was just diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer, and it's in my bone. So I suddenly am realizing in this conversation you're having, am I now eliminated from being a candidate? The cancer is in my bone. It's not in any organ. Do they check the organs to see if they possibly could still be donated in that tight time window? And I think this question sort of applies to other people with terminal illnesses or chronic conditions.
It's a really good question, and I'm really, really sorry for your diagnosis, and I appreciate your courage in bringing it up and joining the show. Thank you, Anne. Jeff Kahn, what do you think?
Thanks, Anne, for your call. The answer to your question is absolutely they check, and it depends on the, you know, the illness or disease that the person has when they die. So I would say it's not necessarily the case that you will not be able to be an organ donor, but it totally depends on the diagnosis, what happens at the time of death, and which organs might be affected or not. There's a strong incentive to allow people who are willing to be organ donors to have their organs donated and used because there's such a need. So I would say, you know, good for you for being a donor. I'm sorry for your diagnosis, as Tom said as well. And do ask, you know, as you interact with the professionals who care for you about this question and what you should do about it to make sure your wishes are known and carried out.
Thank you, Anne. I really appreciate it. Let's go to Julia in Baltimore. Julia, welcome to Midday with Dr. Jeff Kahn.
Hey, yes. This show really caught my ear. what I want to know is who pays the final expenses? Because I have listed, I've donated everything, skin, eyes, organs, you name it, a toe or whatever. But who pays the final expenses for, I guess, getting rid of the remains after everything's been
That's a good question, Julie, and it is something that I know folks at Johns Hopkins and other institutions have thought about.
Yeah, so it's a good question, Julie, and again, good for you for being a donor. And I will say too, when we check the box or have the heart on our driver's license, it means that we're not only solid organ donors, but skin and bone and corneas are also part of what we agree to donate. The rest of your remains are the responsibility of your family is the quick answer to that question. People can donate their remains to science for use in research or in pathology labs and teaching medical students. So there are ways to actually make the cost go away altogether. But at the end of the organ and other parts donation, the remains are returned to the family for burial or cremation or whatever people choose.
My wife is a senior writer and editor at Johns Hopkins, oversees some of their publications, and she's written about a ceremony that Johns Hopkins holds every year for the people who died and donated their cadavers and organs to Hopkins, sometimes for research, to allow medical students to, perform various procedures on them, and sometimes for transplantation. So it is something that folks think about very seriously. But Linnell has written about that. If you want to check it out, you can Google Linnell Smith and Johns Hopkins, and you can check that article out. Let's go to Jackie in Baltimore. Jackie, welcome to Midday. Thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I just wanted to speak to the power of organ donation. I work at a program called Power Inside in Baltimore, and we work with homeless women. And we had a client we were helping to get housed, and so we helped her get her ID and register to vote and do the things necessary to apply for housing. And she elected to be an organ donor. And not a week before we got her in her own apartment, living homelessly on the street, she died. And she had that she was an organ donor. She had no next of kin. And we went through the process with her, with Rochelle, to donate an organ to help save a life. And we were just so incredibly moved that a woman who had nothing at all to give except her very organs after her death did that. And we did end up paying for her final arrangements because there was no support for that. And it's just, I really think how she would smile down on what had happened in having given that gift to save someone's life.
Yeah.
It was just so meaningful, and it's changed a lot for us and how we view the gifts and resources that people have, that when they have nothing, that they still want to give.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jackie, and God bless you for the work you're doing and for her to make that decision to be an organ donor. I mean, Jeff Kahn, one of the things that evidently you've had to consider, for example, in the case of kidney donations, there are living donors who give their kidneys to other, to recipients. When it comes to penile transplants, would it be possible for a living donor to decide to donate his penis to somebody else?
It's a really interesting question. I will say, first in response to Jackie's comment, it's a very powerful thing to be an organ donor and in your death allow many others to live. It's sort of hard to say it in a more direct way than that. So it's something that's worth sort of pondering. Living donation has been sort of an answer to the shortage in the context of kidney transplant. And as you rightly point out, individuals may give one of their kidneys, not both, to a person who's waiting on the waiting list and needs a kidney transplant. And it's a way of making more kidneys available. A little unclear what would happen in the case of somebody offering their penis while they're alive to somebody. I was at a professional meeting where a military physician actually stood up during the question and answer session and asked exactly that question. What would you, the transplant team, and the folks who advise them on the ethics say if a 60-year-old father said, I want to give my penis to my 22-year-old son? He needs it more than I do. I'm done using it in that way, and I'm happy to donate it. What would we say? It doesn't kill that man to be that donor. Alters his life, but in a way that he's certainly informed about. So is it like being a kidney donor, or is it like something else that we would not permit? No one has said, I want to give one of my hands as a living donor to somebody who needs it, although we might sort of see that in the same way. So it's a really interesting and important question that has not yet been addressed as a matter of practice.
We have a few minutes left, and I want to switch topics now, and that has to do with this notion of genetic testing and the availability of genetic information. In California, the so-called Golden State Killer was apprehended and at least charged. His trial hasn't happened yet, but this is a man named Joseph DeAngelo, who was a former police officer who committed a number of murders over a long period of time, some of them dating back 30-some years. And the investigators, it was a cold case for a long time. The investigators got him, not because they necessarily found his genetic information posted on a website, but because they found genetic information of people related to him that led them to him. How did that work? And how is it that people related to Officer DeAngelo had their genetic information available on one of these, it's like Ancestry.com or something.
Yeah. So the short answer is there has been an explosion in direct-to-consumer genetic testing through companies like Ancestry.com, 23andMe, where you can pay a relatively small amount of money, have a kit sent to you, do a cheek swab and send it back, and they will perform a very broad genetic examination of your genome. Not quite a full sequence, but getting closer by the day. And that information then lives on databases. You can put it up yourself. It lives on databases that the places like 23andMe actually offer for access for sale to pharmaceutical and biotechnology companies. And so it's effectively a data collection enterprise that's being more and more widely available. In this case, the detectives posed as others on Ancestry.com. So they didn't actually go in as investigators and say law enforcement has a right to access this information. They created a fake identity and then searched to try to find matches based on the DNA that had come from some of the crime scenes to see if there were a match to the person who they ended up arresting. And so it raises all sorts of questions about who should have access to these databases and for what purposes, and when, if ever, should law enforcement be allowed to mine what are consumer data sets with genetic information. It's a new era, I guess, is the short answer to that question, and we need to figure out what to do about privacy and confidentiality and who should have access.
Yeah, wow, is it ever a new era. In California, the investigators use a thing called GEDmatch.com. When it comes to the privacy of this data, when you do the swab and you allow this to be posted in whatever internet forum you choose, who owns that at that point? Do you still own it? Does the company own it? And then do they make decisions about disseminating that information?
The answer almost always is the company owns that data, and the terms of service, which are part of what you check off, right? You check here if you want to continue or click the box, determines what the terms of use are. And people don't read those, right? It's like every other website that we access or app that we use where it says, click here if you agree to the terms of service. Nobody reads those. You might scan them quickly, but if you don't agree with them, you can't use the site or the app. And so we tend to just say, okay, even though we might not agree with the services and terms and probably don't know what they are. And so in the case of these DNA sites, it's all spelled out, but people don't know what's there and don't have a way of fixing it.
And if you choose to post your own data, are you sort of ergo making available a certain amount of data about people who are related to you, who may or may not be with you on this decision to publish.
Well, right. And that's, I guess, the point about the Golden State Killer. So other people's genetic information, right, allowed them to match up, the detectives to match up the DNA from crime scenes with people who were related to the person who they've now arrested as the killer. And so, of course, our DNA is not only about us, it's about those who are related to us. And so, absolutely, it's posting information about other people without their knowledge and therefore without their consent. But that's the deal with DNA. It's all in the family.
Yeah, and there's a number of really good things that have happened because of this,
sure,
because of the availability. I have a very good friend who just discovered a half-brother that she never knew she had because of her genetic information being available, and so was his, and, you know, they found each other.
Sure. There's information that's interesting to be gained. There's information that's really valuable for one's health to be gained. And so there are stories now coming out about sites like 23andMe sending information back to people which they would not otherwise have known, which sent them directly to their healthcare provider and identified a risk of cancer that needed to be addressed and luckily was able to be addressed. So it's everything from, oh, isn't it interesting that my ancestry is X percent from this part of the world and Y percent from a different part of the world, which is, okay, interesting enough, but doesn't have direct bearing on one's health, all the way through to actual healthcare information that one would make decisions about. And then we've got this question about forensic and law enforcement uses, which people didn't really realize was part of the deal when they signed up, but may or may not be, depending on the particular site.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. All right. Always good to see you, Jeff Kahn. Appreciate it. And look forward to the next time.
Me
Thanks
too.
So much.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Jeffrey Kahn joins us every couple of months for Midday on Ethics. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. We've got links to the Berman Institute and to more information on our website, wypr.org/midday. Coming up after a quick break, Sean Yost, the Baltimore editor of the Afro-American newspaper and the co-host of a new WYPR podcast, Truth and Reconciliation, stops by for the Afro check-in. Before we take that break, every week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who lost their lives to violence in our city in the previous week. We stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 111 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. A victim from week before last, whose name was originally reported as Damon Hamilton, has now been identified by police as Damon Hamilton Purley. He was 18 years old. Last week, 6 people were victims of homicide here in Baltimore. They are Antonio Enals, age 29, Reginald White, age 39, Antonio Johnson, age 35, Milton Johnson Jr., age 31, Micha Farrington, age 29, and Jermaine Cornish. He was 27 years old. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.